Every single day I feel it.
Artlist IO.
Every single day I feel the pressure. Double up the work, let's make it extra. Working so my mother get a rest, yeah. Working like I never know I'm best, yeah. Every single day I feel the pressure.
Let's go, let's go. It's your boy Sprout here, the Woody Mano Show, that one studio.
Music licensing reimagined.
Maybe I do, maybe I do. Maybe pressure helps. But anyway, we're back with another great show, great episode. We have two great guests for you today. These guys and fellas that are in the real estate investing space, partnered up, some of their friends as well. I'm sure they're not partners and hate each other. That wouldn't be successful. But I got Sean DuMartel and Mike Ty in the building. They're with a company called Takeoff Capital. And
we're going to talk about the vision, the importance, the importance,
Well, listen, guys, so this show is, as you know, about the ingredients that have gone into making my guests who they are. And, you know, you guys have had some success, and I'm sure your vision is to have even more success. But we want to hear about, like, the things that you went through to get there and the adversities, some of the successes, maybe the aha moments. Like I shared with you guys a little backstory before we got on the show here. You know, some aha moments that I had with regards to podcasting and all. So I'd love to hear that for you guys in business, entrepreneurship, real estate, investing, what have you. But before we do that, we start the show with this question here. And I believe Mike is going to start and then we'll go to Sean. What are you made of, Mike?
Cleveland soot, San Diego salt water, and a little bit of piss and vinegar.
I like that. Did you say Cleveland?
Yeah, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, man. I moved to San Diego.
You're probably suffering like I am. I'm an Eagles fan, and we just watched the most terrible. I think the Browns actually performed better, believe it or not, than the Eagles did.
Debatable, last night, man. Yeah. They both got trumps.
Yeah. So I feel for you, though. But anyway, back from Cleveland to San Diego, and then and some salt water and some all that. Okay, I got it. But we're going to dive into that in a second. Sean, what are you made of?
Man, I'm going to say, so I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. So a big part of it comes from that. A little bit of Louisville, Kentucky bourbon, maybe. I got that San Diego salt water as well. Been out here for about 12 years now. Grew up middle class. And I think all of those experiences definitely is what made me what I am today. So,
well, you know, it's cool. I got both of you guys on a show together. And apparently you have a show, a podcast, mm-hmm. but you guys take turns. So you're not on your own show together. I got you both here on my show together at the same time.
Let's go, baby.
This is a rare event. I have some special power. I think his name's Todd Armstrong. He's the one. Shout out to Todd. So guys, how did you end up in San Diego?
Both probably similar stories. I'll go first. Initially I wanted to, we both were air traffic controllers, and I came out here initially for the Navy. So back in 2011, I joined the Navy specifically to get some air traffic control experience. This ended up being my first and only duty station out here in San Diego on shore duty. So I worked for the Navy for 5 years, got out and got hired as an air traffic controller here in San Diego. And I just never left. I love this city. And so, yeah, I think the Navy brings a lot of people out here and a lot of people never leave.
The weather, dude, the weather is phenomenal. Like it's just awesome. That city, I went out there a couple of times. I got almost attacked by a homeless person. That was the only bad part about that. Well, one other bad thing about San Diego before I get the mic, I went there one time last year, and there was a tropical storm that came in, and I'm like, I come out to San Diego to leave Maryland in the wintertime. I don't want to come out there for some and man, I'm walking in the city that's pouring, and I'm just like, come on, man. But anyway,
yeah, that was a once in a lifetime error that happened. There was a glitch in the matrix, I think.
Yeah, the storm got lost. I think it got lost. We're like, hey, Miami's to the east.
You remember that, right? It was about a year ago or less. Yeah. So, Mike, how did you get to San Diego? Same kind of thing?
Basically, same story as Sean. Was stationed out here in the Navy. Only difference is when I got out of the Navy, I got hired up in L.A., worked up there for a little bit, did a quick deployment over to Afghanistan and Djibouti, Africa. I was in San Diego basically my whole naval career, which I guess was just 5 years. But
Well, thank you guys for your service. Appreciate it. And I mean that genuinely, not just to say it. A lot of people just to say it, you know, get it out of the way. I genuinely mean it. The sacrifice and everything. And I never did that. So appreciate it more. somebody else did it.
Thank you very much.
And so when you guys got into the Navy, I want to know this, like, why did you guys decide to go into the Navy?
I'll let you take that
one first. For me, ultimately, my objective, like it says it in my yearbook photo, like you put your future goals. My goal was to get a private pilot's license and to get an air traffic control certification, get hired with the FAA. So I kind of set my intentions. And then I was in a career shadowing program in high school and figured out, was trying to do kind of some due diligence and research on the best way to achieve that outcome. And the when I did career shadowing, a lot of the air traffic controllers I was meeting were like, oh, join the Air Force, join the Navy. It's the easiest way. You don't have to take on student loans. You'll have a little fun in the process. And in the end, you'll get hired. So I was like, okay, yeah, that sounds a little bit more fun than going to one of these aviation academies. So I just went the Navy route and got my pilot's license while I was active duty and got my air traffic control certifications. And it all kind of worked out where I got that air traffic control position, which was originally my goal.
Sean?
Yeah, similar story to me. I mean, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, was in college at the University of Louisville, and I had switched my major twice. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I was struggling because, like, my family couldn't really afford to put me through college, so I took out a bunch of student loans, and I was working full-time while trying to go to college, and it was just kind of not really working for me. Long story short, I got introduced to this air traffic controller that, like, took me up to the air traffic control tower. And everybody in there was either ex-Navy or ex-Air Force. They made good money. And they were like, yeah, dude, the military will pay off your student loans too, I'm pretty sure. And sure enough, like shortly after that, I checked in with the Navy. I thought that was the coolest branch at the time. And signed up to be an air traffic controller. And all of that ended up coming to fruition. I mean, the plan worked. I got my experience. They paid off my government loans for college. I got my dream job, which was working in a traffic control here in Southern California. Just
did you guys either one of you do that on a ship?
No,
I didn't. I was shore duty the entire time, so I was like probably a lucky one. Air traffic controllers go on ships far less than a lot of the other jobs in the military. But I was over here on Coronado. I believe Mike was too. So it's basically like a peninsula / they call it an island. But yep. It's, you know, I mean, I lived like a normal life. I had weekends off.
Oh, shit. And why didn't you guys decide to go to the academy? Like, what's the difference between enlisting and going to the academy? Obviously, that's officer school. But like, and the reason I'm asking you this is like, we went to the Naval Academy recently. My son won a state championship in football with his team in Maryland here. And they played it at the Naval Academy. And I got there and I'm thinking to myself, like, I never crossed my mind to go to the military. I don't know why. I played college football, but. Why wouldn't somebody want to go to the academy?
I guess my ultimate objective was to be an air traffic controller in the FAA. And to be an air traffic controller, you have to enlist. So you can't go the officer route. So it would just basically go counter to my objective. So that's why I didn't do it.
Okay.
Yeah, same here.
Is it hard to get into the Naval Academy?
It is, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, it's competitive. A lot of smart people go there. But it's not easy. Usually, like, gotcha. You even have to get, like, I think, like, a letter from your local representative in the government or something like that, right?
I remember when I was looking into it, the GPA and ACT, SAT score requirements weren't, like, super high, but they really wanted to see a lot of extracurricular work. They wanted you to be a National Honor Society, team captain. They wanted to see those kind of things.
Athletics, especially if you're a good football player or something, basketball player. They would. Mm. Yeah, makes sense. All right, so then, guys, how did you guys meet at work? Or how did the relationship start?
Yeah, we met when we were a civilian air traffic controller. So we actually didn't even meet in the Navy, but we worked at this building called SoCal TRACON. Long story short, it's basically all radar facilities. So we weren't up in the tower. And this building controls all of the approaches and departure control for Southern California, everything from Burbank and LAX and Orange County all the way down. Uh-huh. And yeah. Mike and I worked in the Orange County airspace. And so we worked there for I think we were working for like 6 or 7 years together doing that.
Gotcha. And is it stressful, air traffic control? Is that a stressful job?
I'll let Mike answer first on that one.
I mean, it has its moments. You know, I think any job can be stressful. Like, you know, to make a little humor on this, like I worked at Chuck E. Cheese in high school, and that stressed the hell out of me because there's little kids running your legs all day. And, you know, I'm trying to clean up like video game machines and kids are like crying. And so, I mean, the stress, I guess, is kind of relative. It is stressful, but I think all jobs can be a little stressful.
In my opinion, it's really, really stressful when you're training. just because like, you know, you go to a facility and this might be your dream facility. It takes, you know, a year and a half or so to get trained up and qualified. And during that process, like if you don't make it and you wash out, they could send you to basically, they won't fire you usually off the first time, but they might send you to somewhere random, you know, in Iowa or something like that to try and that's a, you know, a smaller facility to try and get your skills up. So like I was always worried about that when I was training, and I was like sweating through my hoodie when I was training. But you know, you work it for a couple of years and you're working that same airspace, you get used to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to piggyback on that. There's a unique aspect to the job, Mike, where like, you know, if you're a physician, if you're a pilot, if you're a lawyer and you graduate your respective school, and let's say you start to the on the job training as a pilot, you're done with your didactics, your curriculum. You have unlimited hours to complete your pilot training. So even if you're really slow to catch on, it's just going to cost you more money in training, but you're eventually going to get it. If you're a bad if you graduate medical school and you're a bad surgeon, like on the actual in practice work, you're still going to eventually be a surgeon. Well, an air traffic controller, when you graduate the educational, you actually have to show that you're competent at doing the job and you have finite hours. So like after so many hours, it's like kind of a shit or get off the pot kind of thing. Yeah. It's like, all right, dude, we've been training you for 3 years. Like if you don't have it yet, you got to go. So I always thought that was kind of interesting that air traffic control is unique in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. Put on top of that, that the FAA is the only employer. It's not like there's all these different companies doing air traffic control. If you don't make it with the FAA, there are some really small airports that have what they call contractor traffic controllers. But I mean, for the most part, there's just one employer. So you get fired by that one. That's it.
Did they teach you something where if you ever got overwhelmed at any one time? They teach you like a protocol to go to, like, I don't know. Like, it seems to me like you're seeing all these freaking planes all over the place and it's just like a lot of confusion. And I can see maybe sometimes some chaos erupting or what have you. So what do they tell you to do when that happens?
Yeah. I guess like, am I overstating it? No, I'm sorry. What?
I said, or am I overstating it?
No. I mean, you're not like there are, certain situations where the workload becomes beyond your capacity. And all you really have to do is say, I need a handoff. You just yell it out and you keep working. And then the supervisor will tell another air traffic controller who's just kind of roving saying, hey, go watch him and help him. And okay. It's just an extra set of eyes. And he's doing a lot of your keyboard entries to reduce your workload. And you're just doing the talking. So that's kind of like all that can really happen.
And
they can divide up the airspace too.
Yeah. And there's like a lot of like other things going on too. Like they have like a traffic management unit and all these other things to where like, if it's getting really insane, which happens, like, you know, especially when the weather is adverse and stuff, it can get crazy fast. And when that starts happening, they'll call airports, you know, contact the airports that have more aircraft supposed to be departing to go to your airport. They'll say, keep them on the ground. Or if they're already in the air, they might reach out to them 150 miles away and start slowing them down. There's all sorts of stuff like that involved to where they can try to manage the flow of traffic coming to you to ease it back up.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah. We have time as passengers. We don't know what the hell's going on.
Exactly. You know, people will blame the airline. They'll be like stuck on the tarmac and they're like, damn it, this is the last time I'm ever flying with Southwest. Yeah. And they have no idea that it could be a problem that's 200 miles away.
That's a good point.
They have no
control.
It could
kill them. They'd rather be pissed off and... Yeah. So let me ask you this, guys, and I'll get off the air traffic control after this. But I'm just intrigued by this. I hope you don't mind. Give me the craziest story from working air traffic control that you guys have.
Oh, I got one.
Go ahead.
Easy.
Wait a minute. But Sean, before you go, Sean, Mike, I need you to make sure you try to one-up him, okay?
Okay. I think I got him beat because I was in Afghanistan. So
okay. Yeah, he's got all kinds of crazy stories. My first day of on-the-job training on my first sector at the place that Mike and I worked with, I had a plane crash. There was a small Cessna that was passing up Orange County Airport and his engine was starting to go out. We were basically telling him, like, you know, my instructor took over and I'm just basically sitting there, you know, in front of the screen while he's speaking. And basically we're just trying to tell the guy, like, go ahead and land at Orange County. You know, it's right at your 3 o'clock, 4 miles, whatever. And he says, no, I think I can make it to Long Beach. And long story short, he didn't. He landed in a field. He survived, but that was definitely crazy for me because it's like, dude, this, you know, this is my first day on the job. I'm sweating. I'm kind of freaking out. This guy's going down, but, you know, and everything ended up being okay.
And you guys dealt with helicopters too, or just planes?
Oh yeah. Helicopters. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Mike, what you got?
Yeah. When I was working in Kandahar, Afghanistan, I was actually at the tower there. Those vertical structures you see at the airport, there's air traffic controllers at the top of those things. And the Secretary of Defense was flying in to Kandahar just to, I don't know, do whatever he does, check on things. And he was flying in an aircraft called a C-17, which is a large Air Force flown cargo plane. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of them in and out all day. Well, the local terrorists or whatever we want to call them tried to set off a bomb to detonate his C-17 right before he touched down at the runway. We have this fence around the perimeter of the airport, but like they can still get within probably like the planes are at like probably 1,000 feet where they can get to the perimeter of the fence and set off a car bomb underneath it. Well, it was the wrong C-17 because there's like probably hundreds of them in and out every day, first of all, and they missed. And there was this huge, I've never seen such a large explosion, this mushroom cloud, like you see like the, not like Hiroshima, but kind of like
that shape of
how you see it happen. So I thought that was just incredible. And a quick funny story, Sean and I weren't there for this, but I think we both heard the story. When the president flies into an airport, they sanitize the airspace. So no one's allowed to like be in the air within whatever mile radius of the airport. Well, I think it was Obama or maybe the president. I think it was Obama was flying into LAX, Los Angeles airport, and no planes are supposed to be in the sky. Well, there's this one little plane just kind of cruising up the coastline, and they had to intercept him and make him land down in Long Beach. And it turns out it was a drug smuggler. He didn't get the memo that the president was coming in. So he got busted over at Long Beach airport. I always thought that's a funny story. So I thought,
One more question. I can't help it, guys. We'll get into real estate in a second.
Dude, it's cool. I love talking about stuff like this. Doesn't matter to me. Real
estate. that might be a little break for you guys. What about UAPs? Any experience with UAPs or any stories?
I don't have any. Like I've heard stories and stuff like that, but I've never had a pilot report anything like that.
Yeah. The UAPs, like the ones that aren't the ones that are getting too close to like a drone or.
Well, I'm talking about UAPs, they call them, and it could be UFOs. It could be kind of things that are coming out now. The news is talked about now. You don't know what to believe. And
I don't have any. I don't have any reports or anything.
Do you guys have clearance, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to have a security clearance. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there might be some things I shouldn't ask. Anyway. Let's move to something else. I don't know, man. I'm intrigued by all this stuff, and I love flying. But you know, you just hear all these different things. You don't know what to believe. All right. So then you guys got together and decided to start getting into some real estate. What was your first deal that you did together? How did it all come together?
Take it away, Sean.
All right. Well, so essentially, our first deal was a 32-unit apartment complex, and that was in basically right on the outskirts of Indianapolis, Greenwood, Indiana, technically, and. Basically, it was me, Mike, and there was one other guy, a couple other guys that got in on this project with us, actually. But we were all like really getting into real estate, studying it heavily, trying to do our own deals, smaller ones. And someone brought up the idea, I think it might have been Rich, that said, why don't we just all put our money together and just go big and go right for an apartment complex? And that's basically what we did. We all liquidated our 401ks, savings, and everything, and bought a 32-unit apartment complex and just went in on it, like basically with the idea that we've got a good base knowledge and we'll figure the rest out. So that's how that deal ended up happening. And there's, obviously all kinds of stuff that happened within that. But that was the first deal, man.
And you did good on the exit?
Oh, yeah. We tripled our initial investment. Little over 2 years. So, I mean, it was a killer investment for sure. Like it was life changing.
And you had a good cap rate. I assume when you started it, like at that time, there's cap rates were still good.
Yeah. I mean, actually like the cap rates compressed a lot. So we bought this value add project. I mean, it was basically, you could say slumlord level. Mike and I always joked that because it was a brick structure, we basically joked that we basically just bought a bunch of stacked bricks because everything needed to be replaced. But yeah, this was a value add project. We added a ton of value. There was still some meat left on the bone, and we sold like basically when cap rates were at their absolute lowest. It was the best time possible to sell.
That's awesome. And then, so what kind of challenges did you have besides, you know, the renovation that you had to do? Like what lessons did you learn on that first deal that you still carry through today?
Oh man, I'll let you go, Mike. We could cover a lot on that.
Yeah. Lessons learned. Kind of like the ultimate, like there's this overarching framework that they always suggest to ensure you never get yourself in trouble. And that's, you know, be well capitalized in your property level account. So basically have enough reserves because there's going to be a rainy day and you want to be ready when that comes. Buy for cash flow, in your real estate. And what's the third rule that I'm forgetting, Sean? Capitalize, buy for cash flow. There's like these three immutable secure laws. Secure
long-term debt. The three immutable laws.
Long-term debt, yeah. So we comply. Basically, you don't want like a one-year loan that it balloons and it's like, hey, you owe me money. Mm-hmm. The loan's due. We complied with all those, except we didn't have sufficient reserves on that project and we had to take on additional debt. In hindsight, I don't know if it was that much of oversight on our end, except what we didn't catch was that essentially all the HVAC systems were shot and had to be replaced. And each unit, you know, 32 times $4,000 to $5,000 each unit for replacement, it adds up. So we had to take out a little loan, just $200,000 private loan. And that really helped us get to the finish line on that one.
And could you have capital raised for that instead of the loan? That would have been an option as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, probably no, because this was a joint venture. So we wouldn't have been able to raise money from passive investors for this project. So we really had no choice other than to come up with the money ourselves or get a loan.
Gotcha. Yeah.
I mean, we could do a capital call amongst the investors and say, hey, anyone want to get more equity in this project and inject some capital? And that would kind of be our version of the capital call. But the debt's just so much cheaper. You know, it's no brainer.
Gotcha. Yeah. And then from there, you fell in love with the real estate and you're like, okay, let's do this again. Like, well, you know, is it kind of like gambling where like my mom, I'll tell the story real quick. I don't know who's listening, but my mom went to the casino and played slots for the first time and won 60 grand her first time playing slots, right? That was the worst thing that could ever happen to her. I think Warren Buffett says something about this. Like the worst thing you can do is have a big score on your first investment or your first business because it kind of tarnishes your thoughts on it. Yeah. Did you guys go through that at all and think that like you're untouchable and you're winners and you can't lose? And
I would say quite the opposite, honestly, because there was like so many lessons that we learned and so many things that went wrong and problems we had to solve with that first deal. I think it humbled us and made us more conservative moving forward. We were a lot more careful now with every one of our projects. I mean, to put it bluntly, like Mike said, we ran out of money on our project and we were able to get out and get a loan. But every project after that and ever since, even to this day with some of our recent acquisitions, we make sure like, you know, the number one thing that we try to focus on is not running out of money, right? So we're really conservative in our underwriting and we raise a lot of extra contingency capital. In fact, we've had people tell us, like just about everybody tells us when we're talking to architects for new builds and all these other things, they're like, man, you guys got a lot of contingency capital. That's the most I've ever seen. Yeah, and it's just because of that experience, man. Like we don't want that to ever happen again.
Because of that feeling, right? Like I when you guys are talking about that kind of thing, I've started many businesses. One of my first businesses was a mortgage business. Mm-hmm. And we were doing these things called streamline refinances where we credited the closing costs to the buyer or to the homeowner ahead of time. We would cover their closing costs for them and just lower their rate. It's called an FHA streamline. And we took the money that we made and we made less of it and paid their closing costs with it, some of the margin. Well, I didn't know that I had to wait to get the margin till we sold the loan. I was just ignorant, right? Mm-hmm. And so here I'm thinking all this thousands of money, thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars is going to come in, probably 100-some thousand. And we had lender credited the money. I didn't know that we had to wait till we sold the loan to get that money back. So when I found that out, that feeling, you know, that feeling right here, you know what I'm talking about, fellas? It's like sinking feeling. So that's what I felt when you were just talking about this HVAC system. And you don't want to have that feeling again. So I love that you did the extra contingency. I mean, who?
Yeah, exactly, man. Like it's now, you know, there's so many lessons we learned from that. I think after that, though, like that even triggered us being more dead set on getting a mentor. So after that project, like we didn't have the big heads like, oh, we know everything we're talking about. Let's go raise a bunch of money from investors now and do this. We were dead set on getting a mentor with somebody with a ton of experience that could like hold our hand through our first couple projects. So
and did that person did they have a coaching program or something that you had to pay for? Or did he just say, yeah, I'll mentor you?
Good question. I'm glad you asked because like when we were looking, we weren't really personally attracted to the coaching programs. We didn't like the idea of, you know, paying a bunch of money to then go through modules. And you most of the time we wouldn't have direct access to that top person that we wanted to be mentored from, with the exception of like, you know, a 1 hour call twice or once every other week or something. Really the way we found our mentor was with our podcast. We had one of our mentors are two brothers that have owned over 8,000 apartment units, and they came out as a guest on our podcast. And when we were kind of just shooting the shit after the podcast, we were telling them like, our experience looking for a mentor and what we really wanted, just one-on-one mentorship that's like, you know, access to these people more than a limited amount of time. And they ended up agreeing to be our mentors. And that's how, and then the first two syndications we did, 150 unit syndication and 145 unit, were both with them.
Gotcha. Okay. And they were in on it with you, so that your values were aligned.
Oh yeah. Not only were they in on it with us, I mean, they invested like, you know, seven figures in the deals and their property management company. So they, alignment of interest through and through.
Yeah. I'd rather do that than a coaching program. Well, I don't know if you guys know this or not, but, I wrote a book and I got Grant to write the foreword for the book, Grant Cardone.
Nice.
So I like him as a person. I don't know what his, what the thoughts are out there in the investing world on that, on him, but like, what are your thoughts and what do you hear out there about the way he raises capital? Like, do people vibe with it? Do people are like shy away from it? Like, what are the thoughts that you guys hear, or what are your thoughts?
I mean, I guess I'll go first. I think that people vibe with all kinds of different people, right? Like, he's, you know, Grant is, I mean, about as good as it gets when it comes to marketing, online marketing and attracting a large audience. I mean, can't argue against that. It's huge. And I think there's a certain type of people that really like his persona, the way he carries himself. And at the end of the day, it's all about trust, and it's more about, you're investing in the person, right? You're investing in the sponsor almost more than the deal, because their track record, them as a person, all that kind of stuff is what builds the trust. And I think there's a lot of people that really resonate with him, and there's a lot of people that don't resonate with him and prefer a different kind of persona or what have you. And I think that that's kind of the case with every general partnership group, in my opinion. Some people will tell me they don't like them and hate them. Some people love them. So I'm sure that's the case across the board, but you know, in my experience, I don't know anybody that's invested in his projects, you know, in his funds. So I couldn't really give any insider information on like, you know, any personal experiences, but yeah, I think that's generally how it goes. What do you think, Mike?
And Mike, yeah, I want to hear from you. But by the way, I'm not talking about him personally, because nobody knows him personally. Most of the people don't know who he is, right? But it's like that style of marketing for raising funds. Is that something that you've heard people like, they're like, actually, not a fan of that, or they like, they wish they could do it?
You know, I think people wish they could do it. I think that most of the people Mike and I have asked about their marketing, because we've, you know, taken all kinds of courses and talked to a lot of people that are successful in this industry, there's a small percentage of people that we've talked to that have had a lot of success with that style of marketing, with that style, especially with like the social media marketing being so heavily and being able to raise that much capital. There's, you know, groups, people that have written very famous books that have said that Instagram is where they've gotten the least amount of traction, but they also have multi-thousand unit portfolios and just have a different style of raising their capital. So I think that, in my opinion, I think that like that kind of a style is a little more rare to see people be super, super successful, but the ones that are super successful are absolutely crushing it because they have so much attention and so many people watching them, so many speaking engagements. So I think it works. It's just hard to get to that level, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mike, your thoughts? Any thoughts on that?
On Cardone's level? Yeah. Are his I guess his tactics.
Marketing, I guess. And
yeah, his marketing tactics. He does like a little bit of, like from the legal perspective, he does what's called a Reg A, Regulation A capital raise, where you're allowed to just blast it out to a wide audience, just whoever you want, really publicly solicit. And there's really no requirements for those investors that come in on, you know, their income level and net worth. And usually there's no minimum investment requirements, so there doesn't have to be. That is
non-accredited, is what you're saying, right? Non-accredited.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know if you were familiar with that term. Yeah. Non-accredited. Where if you don't do a Reg A is very expensive to establish from the legal perspective, where we could solicit to non-accredited through a 506C. I'm sorry, not through non-accredited, it only accredited investors. So Sean and I could do a big social media blast as well, but we could only accept accredited investors. So he's taking a little bit of a different route, where I think he's going for just quantity, you know, which works.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. And then, and yeah, there's some, you know, you got to be careful what you say and what you promise and no guarantees and all that kind of stuff. And, and send people to the disclosures and all that jazz. So, all right, cool. So here's the thing, what I want to wrap this up with. Okay. I want to wrap this up with team, how you build team, how you guys continue to focus and work on your relationship with you guys or anybody else on your team, your investors,
I think, and you see if you, your thoughts, like, I think this all starts with core values and having a mission and being in alignment with what your core values are and making sure that you have the people, you know, that your investors that you want to be, you know, in a relationship with, in a way, right? Like, what are your thoughts on how do you guys maintain relationships with each other and then with your investors?
You want to take that, Mike?
I think that's something that Sean and I have, we've talked about a lot. And to be honest, I don't think we're that good at it yet. We have a lot of room for improvement. We've partnered with other people before, not partnered, but I guess we've hired other people before that really helped us with it. And they're not currently with us, but Sean and I revisited, like, even bringing people back that have maybe they bring a little bit of value to the organization, Sean and I's business, as far as human-to-human connection, investor outreach, and things like that. So I think Sean and I's strength is really with the numbers, analyzing or being analytical and finding the best deals and things like that. And I think maybe a weak point just in our business is that outreach, in my opinion. So how do we address that? I guess is your question. If that is not your strong point, then you hire someone who does have that as a strong point. You bring them in your business and you kind of agree on what the practices and protocol will be. And then that's how you kind of incorporate it into your business practices, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Sean.
Yeah. Thoughts? I would agree. I think that, like, when it comes to especially building those relationships with investors, Mike and I have invested an enormous amount of time, money, and effort in 2023 on improving that aspect, bringing in marketing companies and capital raising companies and people to help us bolster that up. And I think a lot of it, what we've learned and improved upon, is really your investors seeing you more, right? Whether that's social media, your podcast, email campaigns a lot, but really just giving them updates on what you're doing constantly so that they see behind the curtain what you're doing day in and day out as a real estate investor, giving them, like, really thorough updates on our properties and market reports and things like that, because all of that really plays into them building more trust with you. And really, I think a lot of people also don't realize your level of knowledge and whatnot as a real estate investor, unless they've already been following you for a long time. And all of that stuff really gives you the opportunity to show off too, build that level of trust and that, and the, them looking and seeing you and saying, man, I've been watching this guy for the past 12 months. These guys, I see how knowledgeable they are and how much they're crushing it. And now I want to invest with them. So we've been really picking it up a lot with that. And then I think just even within the organization, you know, keeping the relationship tight and doing those kind of things, I think it requires just constant coordination and structure. Another thing that Mike and I improved upon, having set meeting times 3 days a week where we work on certain things, tracking absolutely everything, using all kinds of software to track tasks and where we're at. I think that really helps the business internally, because it reduces stress levels a ton. You know where we're at with everything in the process. Clarity. And what the other guy's working on. All that stuff, I feel like, helps your business relationship internally.
Yeah, clarity, man, gives you some relief. I mean, let's relax. All right, fellas, listen, I want to thank you for being here. And you know, the conversation was great. I appreciate you going outside of the real estate realm too with me and sharing what you guys are made of. I look forward to building upon a relationship with you guys and learning more about what you do and who you are, more importantly. But thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks so much for having us, man. This was awesome. This is a cool podcast.
Thank you, Rock. It was fun.
All right. Hang tight while I wrap this up. All of you watching or listening, however you're consuming this content, I really appreciate you. As human beings, and also for your attention, your eyeballs, your ears, it means the world to me. And I can't do my mission, which is all people are unstoppable to live in the life of their dreams without you. And until next time, it's your boy C-Rock signing off from That One Studio on the What Are You Made Of Show. Be That One.